Call the meeting of the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. And since we're not taking any votes, we do have a quorum, but it's not really that important today. But and I've been dragging my feet so that our one member that we were waiting for could arrive, and he's arriving now. So welcome, Representative Rukavina.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just trying to keep up your promptness when I share
this. Need to make an entrance, right? So we appreciate your attendance. We're basically right on time, and having a committee meet right after lunch is maybe not the best scheduling, because if we were home, we'd all take a nap, but we have to work. So so appreciate you being here on time. First thing we'll do is just note the roll. The clerk will note the roll. Everyone's here? I think so. Yep. This meeting will be rather brief today, so he'll give you a little more time this afternoon to do other things. And we will begin, actually, by officially getting to know each other and introductions. And my name is Bud Nornes. I'm beginning my eighth term in the House of Representatives and my second time around as chairman of this committee, and appreciate being able to do that. I represent part of West Central Minnesota, Otter Tail County, if you know where that is, the west half of Otter Tail County. I feel somewhat lucky because my legislative district is one half of one single county, so it makes life pretty easy, and pretty easy to describe. It's lakes country, farming country, pretty diverse part of the state. My background before becoming a legislator, I was in broadcast business, owned and operated an AM/FM radio station in Fergus Falls. Elected in 1996. I think that's probably it for me, and we'll just go around to my left, please.
My name is Chelsea Thompson. I'm going to be the CLA for the Higher Education Committee. I'm also the Legislative Assistant for Representative Nornes and Bedner.
I'm Kathy Novak. I'm with the House Research Department and staff to the committee.
Good afternoon. Joe Atkins. I represent Invergrove Heights, South St. Paul, and Sunfish Lake.
I should add one more thing for members. If they care to add anything besides their name and address, you're welcome to waive time. So if you're inspired, go ahead.
Representative Jean Poppy from Austin, southern Minnesota, and I represent a Minsky school. I have Riverline Community College in my district, and I also work at Riverline Community College.
She's the queen of spam from...
I'm proud of it.
That's right. Exactly. I'm Tom Rukavina, and I am in my 13th term now. He's been around a long time. I represent the eastern part of the Iron Range, all in St. Louis County. And from where I grew up, I could throw a stone and hit three of the six operating mines in Minnesota. And my entire district depends on iron ore mining.
My name is Connie Depke. I represent the Lake Minnetonka area. I have 11 towns around the lake. It's one biggest mass in my district is that particular body of water. I'm looking forward to being on this committee. I have spent the last 12 years concentrating on K-12 education and early childhood for the business community, as well as being on a school board, and I am looking forward to working on a higher ed committee.
Gene Kowalski, Winona, Houston County.
And Mark Malander, I'm the DFL caucus researcher.
I'm Kurt Dout from District 17A, which is Isani County. Just a little bit of Anoka County and a little portion of Chisago County. And I also have a Minsky school in my district, which is the Cambridge Community College.
So. I'm Bruce Vogel from District 13B, and I represent most of Kandiyohi County, the Wilmer area, and we also have Ridgewater College in my district.
Good afternoon. King Banyan from District 15B, St. Cloud, northern eastern portions, Haven Township. Now, I have a couple schools in my district, but nearest and dearest to my heart, St. Cloud State, where I've worked for the last 26 years as a professor.
Mr. Chair, Pat Mazerol from District 41B, represent West Bloomington and South Edina. In that district, we have Normandale Community College and a remote facility for Bethel University, which is also where I'm employed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Hancock, I represent District 2B, which is Park Rapids and North. Graduated from a school in Indiana. I don't have a degree from a Minnesota school, but am in good relationships with Bemidji State, and go Beavers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Benson, I represent District 30B, which is a very southern portion of Rochester and parts of Wabasha and Olmsted County. I'm an assistant professor of business at a small Christian college, Crossroads College in Rochester, and although they're not in my district, I have a special interest in Rochester Community College and the new University of Minnesota, Rochester.
Mr. Chair, I'm Terry Morrow, represent District 23A, Nicollet County, half of Sibley County. Mr. Chair, I'm almost pleased, I think, that there might be more professors and lawyers finally on a committee. I teach at Gustavus Adolphus College.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Doug Berg. I'm with the Office of Fiscal Analysis. I'm staff to the committee.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Detmer from 52A, Northern Washington County, Eastern Anoka County, Bemidji State grad many years ago, and also St. Thomas University. And looking at the members of this committee, I'm sure it's going to be a lively committee. And I've served on this committee the last two terms, so looking forward to it.
I'm Mike Valu. I'm the committee administrator.
I should have. Marissa. Sorry.
Thought I got out of it. Larissa Fisher, Republican Research.
I neglected to say that I have a community college in Fergus Falls, and it's celebrating its 50th year this year. So it's been a special time for our community college that continues to serve the community in the area well, but has a lot of challenges in front of it as well. So, in your packets, you will find basically a little information dealing with the committee, specifically the rules, perhaps. And we won't spend a lot of time on it. They're essentially... Find my copy. There we go. I think essentially pretty much the same as what we have operated under in previous years. We like to start on time. That's, I think all chairs want to do that if possible, and notify if you're not able to attend. However, we would probably still mark you as excused if you do not for some reason do that, but we suggest that should be the policy. Think maybe in some of your, especially for the freshmen, you've been instructed on the microphones, how they operate. They're always on unless you turn them off, and that's a good thing to remember, because you could be having a conversation without realizing that you're being taped. So push the little red button if you're going to talk to somebody. It's just a good thing. Some of the cell phones do interfere with the speakers. We suggest turning them off if you can, or put them on silence or vibrate or whatever you do. But occasionally we'll hear some interference, and that's generally, they've apparently concluded it's cell phone interference. So so try and remember, if a cell phone goes off, it's not going to automatically result in anything bad happening. So if you've had a chance, or maybe not, I guess looking through the rules, if anyone has any questions, you, Tommy.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, on rule number 8, and you know I the only rule when I chaired the committee for 4 years was there wasn't any rules. So I kind of let everybody do what they needed to do. And I'm just wondering what you mean by a substantive amendment. And I see you're giving yourself a little discretion. So, I mean, you know, sometimes you just have to do an amendment on the fly. And I'm just wondering how severe you're going to enforce them or not.
We will be. This is ideal. This is where we'd like it to be. But we will make exceptions if we have to as we go along, understanding that things change. And so we'll understand that and deal with it at the time.
And, Mr. Chair, I know you to be a fair guy, so you're going to be as fair as I was, right?
Fairer.
Good.
Oh, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, to follow up on Representative Rukavina on number 8, assuming that we are all good and get you the substantive amendments by 12:30, will you be getting those then to the minority lead at the same time so we can know what the amendments are before the next day?
Yes, I would think that'd be sure. No problem.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, the reason for the deadline is that not only we know what's happening, but the public also. You know. Any other questions dealing with the rules? Again, I'm not fond of a lot of rules, so we'll kind of operate on the fly when we need to. So, okay. If there are no other questions on the procedures, I think we covered that. At this time, we're going to have a quick overview on some of the areas that this committee deals with. And Kathy Novak from House Research will give the first presentation.
Mr. Chair, it's the dynamic duo.
Yes.
Okay. And Mr. Berg.
Hello, I am Mr. Chair and members. I'm Kathy Novak. As I said, I'm with the House Research Department and staff to this committee. I've staffed the Higher Ed Committee for over 10 years now. So this is going to be a really high-level overview of the hitting just the highlights of the public systems of higher education in Minnesota and something about the private education that's important in this state. I would like to touch on some of the enrollment trends and a little bit about the cost of attendance, something about financial aid, its administration and distribution, and then some trends and appropriations, and then Doug will talk much more about the appropriations and the accounts. And I'm going to be working off of the document that you have in your packet. The first page says overview of higher education, and I am not going to be using overheads or PowerPoint or anything, so you're going to have to bear with me, and I'll try to reference the page numbers. We're going to start out on page 2 with the University of Minnesota. The university is one of the two public systems in Minnesota. It actually predates the state. It was chartered in 1851, and that charter was then incorporated into the constitution of the state of Minnesota when Minnesota became a state. It is the state's major research university. It's also a land-grant university under the Federal Morrill Act. As you can see on this page, it has five major campuses now. We've added Rochester. And the largest of those by far is the Twin Cities campus with undergraduate enrollment of over 30,000 students and graduate enrollment of nearly 14,000. There are campuses and outreach centers scattered throughout the state. The university is governed by a 12-member Board of Regents, and this session the legislature will be electing four regents. There will be one at-large member elected and three representing congressional districts, the 2nd, the 3rd, and the 8th district. So that will be the responsibility of the legislature this session. Under the charter and then the constitution, the regents are charged with the governance of the university. They're elected to staggered 6-year terms, and the president, the new president, and the current president will serves as the ex officio head of the Board of Regents.
Ms. Novak, I think we have a question. Can we just stop for a moment?
I'm sorry.
Representative Demke.
I just had two questions.
Sure.
You know, I have never really understood what it means to be a
Mr. Chairman and Representative Demke, the Morrill Act was passed in the 1800s, and it gave a certain amount of land to the states to encourage education, both K-12 education and higher education. There were certain requirements to be a land-grant university. You had to have an agricultural program and you had to have a science program. The University of Minnesota was in existence at the time that the Land-Grant Act was passed, and the legislature designated the University of Minnesota as the land-grant recipient to the land-grant university. So it now carries with it certain obligations under the original Morrill Act to do outreach, to have continue to have an agricultural program, to have science education. It also continues to provide some funding through the original land grants that primarily go now to support professors and teaching at the university. So,
thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman,
the other question is on the Board of Regents, does this committee review the candidates before it goes to the House floor? And do we have a chance to do that, or is that maybe something we do?
Mr. Chairman and members, there is a role for this committee in the process to elect the regents. The regents' elections are governed by joint rules of the House and the Senate, and by the statute, and ultimately by the constitutional requirement to elect regents. And under all of those provisions, the House and Senate Education Committees meet as a joint committee to review candidates that are recommended to it by the Regents Advisory Committee and to forward recommendations to the Joint Convention of the House and the Senate. So, yes, you will have a role to play in that.
Thank you.
Representative
Mr. Martino? Chair, just a couple of points to Representative Demke and to the committee. Land-grant college, as a land-grant college, they also got mineral rights. And so the University of Minnesota has a permanent university fund, I think, that's endowed at about $350 million. The majority of that came from iron ore and taconite royalties. And I just by chance had asked the DNR royalties for both the school trust fund and the university trust fund. And just to give you an idea, Keewatin Taconite Plant, owned by U.S. Steel, paid $9 million in royalties to the university last in 06, $8 million in 07, and they're going to be paying about $10 million a year to mine the ore the university owns over the next 4 years or so. And there is about estimates of up to $1.5 billion worth of mineral, non-ferrous mineral wealth in northeastern Minnesota, a huge amount owned by the university. So I'm asking the university to get involved in the whole non-ferrous, at least support it, because a lot of their chairs, the endowed chairs at the University of Minnesota, are endowed through that permanent university fund. And then as far as the selection of regents, we all get to do whatever we want. That's what it says in the Constitution. And, you know, for those of you, we used to get together as congressional districts, and if you're if your region is up this year. Ours is up. In fact, our region from the 8th Congressional District has decided not to run again. And usually what we've done in the past, and almost always have adhered to it, is whatever the number of legislators from that congressional district recommend, that was the way we went in the past. I'm not a big supporter of the Region Selection Committee because as a legislator, we are given certain rights in the Constitution, and one of them is we meet in joint session with the Senate and decide who gets elected to the Board of Regents.
Are you done? Question, did you get all that information from that phone?
Actually, sent it, yeah. And by the way, there are 27 minerals in this phone, the majority of which could be mined in Minnesota to make it work.
Ms. Novak?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Leaving the University of Minnesota and going to page 3, we have the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, which is the other public higher education system in the state. This system was formed by a merger in law that was finalized in 1995. So it is not a constitutional body, but it's a statutory body. It accounts for the largest enrollment of post-secondary students in Minnesota. As you can see on the map, there are campuses throughout the state. There are two-year state colleges, which consist of community colleges, technical colleges, and then consolidated community and technical colleges. And two-thirds of the MinSCU enrollment is in these two-year colleges. There are 32 institutions, and they operate 54 campuses in 47 communities throughout the state. They have about 10% of the state university enrollment. There are 7 state universities, and about 10% of their total enrollment is in graduate education. A few years ago, we expanded the type of graduate education that could be provided by state universities to include applied doctorate degrees, so that is a policy prerogative of the legislature to get involved with the types of degrees that are offered. MinSCU is governed by a board of trustees. The trustees are not elected by the legislature. They are appointed by the governor. There is a similar process to review candidates, but ultimately the selection is up to the governor and who is put onto the board of trustees. Again, they represent the 8 congressional districts and several at-large, and they also have student members. Going on to page 4, private post-secondary education.
Ms. Novak, I think maybe our page numbers are just different. Just
are they a little different?
We'll be on page 5 now.
Okay, going on to page 5. private post-secondary education is important in Minnesota. There are about 180 private post-secondary institutions that have a physical presence here. There are some who are licensed or registered to provide education in the state, but they're located outside of Minnesota. These tend to vary all over the place, from very tiny beauty schools, massage therapy schools, to very large universities, and some of the new organizations that are providing post-secondary education, like the University of Phoenix, are registered to provide education in Minnesota. There's many different ways of categorizing private post-secondary education. One of it is ownership. Who owns it? There's private nonprofit organizations. We think of these as primarily the four-year institutions, like the various saints, St. Scholastica, St. John, St. Thomas, St. Olaf. I've missed a few, but
Concordia.
Well, yes, there are others who are not saintly, but also provide four-year liberal arts education, McAllister, Hamlin. I have to stop because I know if I go farther I will miss somebody and that will be bad. Most of them offer liberal arts degrees and some of them also offer graduate education. Then there are private for-profit. They're organized as corporations and they make a profit. Many of these are what we call private career schools. Most of their programs can be completed in less than 2 years, and they may or may not offer degrees. Some of them offer associate degrees, associate of applied science degrees, baccalaureate, and sometimes graduate degrees. Another way of cutting the private post-secondary category is to look at whether they are degree or non-degree granting. The degree grant, and actually this is how they are licensed and registered in Minnesota now by the Office of Higher Education. And it's on the basis not of their ownership, but of whether they what type of credential that they offer. That's that cell phone thing.
There we go.
Not me.
And so those that offer degrees offer 2-year, 4-year graduate degrees. Those who are non-degree granting institutions have credentials and specialized programs. Another way to look at it is whether the post-secondary institution participates in the state grant program. And in order to participate, private institutions are eligible for the state grant program. They have to be located in Minnesota. They have to be licensed or registered. They have to participate in the Pell Grant program or have some grandfathered in capacity to be part of that program. And the table on page 5 kind of cuts the programs various ways. And as you can see, the for-profit degree-granting institutions, there are 5 of them, and they enroll about 31,000 students. And the nonprofit degree-granting institutions, there's 31, and they enroll about 68,000 students. And those are the programs that participate in, or the programs and institutions that participate in the state grant program.
We have a question, if I can interrupt for a moment.
Sure.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Novak, thank you for page 5 and for that information. There's no expectation you should be able to name all 17 degree-granting 4-year liberal arts colleges. Gustavus was one of them.
Yeah, I knew.
No, it's okay. Mr. Chair, I am appreciative that the private college information is included. I know sometimes there's a tendency, given that the legislature has the direct impact on the budget of both MNSCU and the University of Minnesota, but we do have 70,000 students at the private as well, and I know that that will be a major topic as we move forward and talk about things such as the state grant program and the like. So I thank you for ensuring that these institutions are included in the materials.
Ms. Novak, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going on to page 6, I'm not going to talk a lot about these, but these are some enrollment trends. In 2009, Minnesota had about 340,000 undergraduates. As you can see by kind of the speckled bar, the 2-year public institutions account for around a third, a little bit more than a third of total enrollment. There were 134,000 in 2009, and there has been this has been the sector that has seen probably the largest growth in enrollment. In just for one point of comparison, in 2002 there were approximately 110,000 students enrolled in public 2-year institutions, and that had grown to 134,000 by 2009. Graduate enrollment has been relatively stable over the past decade. There's been a little bit of variation in the private colleges, but primarily it's been steady at the state universities. It's grown a bit since 1999 at the University of Minnesota. On page 7, we're going to switch now to how much it costs to go to college, and it does cost a lot. And we know that tuition has been growing, and this is the graph on the top of the page compares the two-year public, the state universities, the University of Minnesota, private four-year colleges, including both nonprofit and for-profit institutions, and then the private career schools are a separate category. And you can see that tuition at both the high and low end has increased in all types of institutions, and that there is overlap. And so it depends on the particular program and institution how much tuition you're going to pay. You can find career schools that are more expensive than a four-year university. So it varies a lot. In the public sector, tuition has become a more important part of their revenue stream over this period of time. It used to be in the Minsky system, at least, that about two-thirds of the contribution to total revenue came from the state, and that's now approaching, I believe, about 50%. So there's been a change. The other agency that we have in this committee that we're responsible for is the Office of Higher Education, which is now a cabinet-level office. It's run by a director who's appointed by the governor. It has a number of responsibilities, including administering student aid programs. It is responsible for the registration and licensing of private institutions in Minnesota. It has an important role in the analysis and collection of data on higher education. And it is charged in law with providing information to students and their families on attending college. And it also provides support for the technology and the library programs in the state. We've talked a little bit about its registration and licensing of private institutions. I think that is a responsibility that they have under the state statutes. There's two chapters that address it, one for the non-degree granting institutions and a separate section of law for those who grant degrees. Minnesota has a need-based financial aid program. It's kind of our flagship financial aid program. We rank relatively high in the amount of financial aid that we provide to students in the state. This program, the only states that kind of rank above us are those who have lottery-based financial aid programs. And they're structured, those types of programs tend to be structured a lot differently than our need-based financial aid that really focuses in on how much it costs to go to school and how much students can afford, and the state picks up the rest of it, the state and the federal Pell Grant. We are in about the top 10 of states on the amount of need-based aid that we give to students. On page 8, there is kind of a breakdown of student financing for higher education in Minnesota. And you can see that the financing has gone up, and it's gone up for two reasons. One, enrollment has gone up, and the other reason is the cost of attendance has gone up. And so the amount of financing required has also gone up. There's some research that suggests that loan amounts have gone up faster than the cost of attendance, that students have taken out more. Their increase in borrowing has superseded the increase in tuition. But in 2009, there was about 1.6 $1.5 billion in loans to students in Minnesota to attend post-secondary institution, and that compares to about $1.2 billion in loans in 2007. So there has been substantial growth in those. Grants and scholarships have also gone up, and this is from all sources, not just state grants or the federal grants, but also institutional grants. In 2009, there was $1.1 billion in grants and scholarships, and that compares to about $864 million in 2007. The kind of complicated graph on the bottom of page 8 just breaks this down by the type of grant. So total aid is made up of grants, loans, and work study. Work study is both federally and state supported, but it is, as you can see, a very, very tiny slice of that pie. Most of it is in loans and then grants. About half of the amount of grants you can see in the circle on the right-hand side of the page is institutional grants. This comes in the form of tuition discounting and other forms of financial aid. The state grant program makes up about 17% of the total grants that go out. The federal, primarily Pell Grant, makes up over a quarter of the grants. On the loan side, the federal government accounts for the vast majority of loans that are made to finance post-secondary education, over 80%. Our state loan program is about 7%. And then institutions and private loans are the other 13%. If we look a little more deeply at how much students get in grants, on page 9, you can see that in 2009, over 84,000 students received a state grant, and the average award was nearly $1,700. The federal Pell Grant, which in that year had a maximum of $4,731, almost 100,000 students received a Pell Grant, and the average award was $2,675. Now, you can't add the number of students who received a Pell Grant to the number of students who received a state grant, because there's a lot of overlap. You know, many students receive both types of grants, but the state grant is only available to Minnesota resident undergraduates. So students who come to Minnesota to attend school from another state are not eligible to receive a state grant. Minnesota students who leave the state to attend college in another state are also not eligible. So it's only Minnesota residents who stay in the state to attend college and have financial need. There were 242,000 resident enrollees in Minnesota, and of those, over 84,000 received a state grant. The total grant award was about $143 million in 2009. The graphic in the middle of the page on page 9 shows the percent of undergraduate students who are enrolled in the various types of institutions. On the right-hand side of that graphic, the bars show the percent of the grant awards that they got. So, for example, without going through all of them, if you look at the MinSCU two-year on the bottom two bars, it accounts for 43% of the Minnesota resident undergraduates in enrollment. And 20% of the grant funds went to Minnesota students attending two-year MinSCU institutions.
Ms. Novak, we have a question if we can just interrupt for just a moment. Representative Norton, you missed the introductions earlier. Would you like to introduce yourself first and then ask the question? Can you do that?
Sure. Kim Norton, I represent Rochester, half of Rochester. and I apologize for being late. I thought we weren't meeting till Thursday, and it was my error with my calendar.
Glad
so
you're here.
I'll be here from now on.
Go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. As I'm looking at this information, a couple thoughts kind of came to mind, and so if it's here and I'm missing it, I apologize, but I'm just going to ask it. It ties to the cost of our tuition in the state of Minnesota's cost of tuition compared with other states. As I'm looking at this information, there's some data here, and on the next page, kind of looking at Minnesota students coming and going from the states that we have that reciprocity agreement, I'm wondering about students coming to the state of Minnesota outside of that reciprocity agreement, and if we are, because if my assumption is correct and that our tuition is high in the state of Minnesota compared to other states, and I guess that would be a question, is it, to other states in the Midwest and the country, is that high tuition and the grants available only to Minnesota residents, which you just clarified for me, are we not then making ourselves a magnet for out-of-state tuition, out-of-state students who might not want to even look here because of our high tuition? I'm saying it asked backwards, if you will, and I apologize for that. But I'm just trying to get at being a high tuition state and a high grant state might make us less interesting to people outside of the Minnesota area, and we're already losing plenty because of the reciprocity to other states and not bringing them in. For those that don't get the state grants, are we shooting ourselves out of some business, I guess, is what I'm looking at.
Ms. Novak?
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, there are a couple things embedded in your question, I think. One is out-of-state tuition relative to resident tuition. And so it's kind of the basis of your comparison. I think for places that charge out-of-state tuition, a non-resident tuition rate, University of Minnesota at most of its campuses charges a non-resident tuition rate. That is higher than its resident tuition rate, and most universities in the United States also do that. So there's a big differential. So when students are comparing tuition rates, they have to make the correct comparison. In the MinSCU system, there are a number of institutions, and I don't have the list with me, who have a single tuition rate. Those institutions may, I don't know how they compare relatively to other types of institutions, but the fact that they have a single tuition rate would make them more attractive to compared to other institutions that charge a differential in their tuition. So there's that part of it. The reciprocity program, I just want to back up and say the Minnesota legislature typically has not gotten involved in regulating tuition at its public post-secondary institutions. There was a directive in the last legislative budget to both the University of Minnesota and the MinSCU system to hold tuition down in recognition of receiving the stimulus funds. And that was the requirement of the federal stimulus funds. So there is some precedent for giving directions on tuition, but we typically haven't done that. So the reciprocity program is designed to mitigate the cost of tuition in making a decision about where to attend college among the states that participate in the reciprocity program. It doesn't completely eliminate the differential, but it mitigates it. And the participating institutions in Minnesota, it's all public institutions, have tended to support it as a way to attract students. as you'll see, and when we go to the reciprocity program, which is next, we are actually a net exporter of students under the reciprocity program. So those are all good questions that have kind of interrelated analysis.
Yep.
If we turn now to the tuition reciprocity program, Minnesota has a reciprocity program with North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin, and much smaller programs with Iowa and Manitoba. This program was designed, it's been around for a very long time, and it is designed to increase student choice in where they attend. And it also recognizes that this group of states really depends on each other to attract students and to go to their post-secondary institutions. There are differences in tuition amounts among the various types of state, and these are handled through the reciprocity agreement. The program is authorized in law, but it's implemented through a set of agreements that kind of spell out how tuition in the various states will be treated. It's available for both graduate and undergraduate students with certain exceptions. The chart on page 10 shows that Minnesota tends to send more students, and this is a long-term trend. This is 1 year, but every year that I've looked at, it tends to be this way. So we tend to send more students than we attract to this state. And in part, I believe it is because of the location of where, for example, Wisconsin has a lot of four-year institutions on the Minnesota border, and Minnesota doesn't have very many public four-year institutions on the eastern side of the state. So it's a result of that, and there may be other explanations. Finally, to wrap up, the graph on the bottom shows the trends in general fund expenditures. You can see there has been some ups and some downs, and the last couple years have been down for the public institutions. Appropriations to the Office of Higher Ed, primarily for the state grant program, have been relatively flat. Unless there are questions, Mr. Berg will go into the financial programs more.
Mr. Berg?
Mr. Chairman, members, as I said, I'm Doug Berg. I'm a fiscal analyst. There are two additional pieces in your packet. One is a text labeled higher ed. This is just reference. I won't go through it. Summaries of fiscal changes made by the legislature during the current biennium, the last two legislative sessions, as well as the last two spreadsheets. So that's just for reference for members. It's also on the House website, on the fiscal analysis website, if you want to see that. And it's suitable for propping under your desk if it rocks or if you have insomnia or something like that. But I won't go through it. The other is a short packet that starts with a single pie chart on the cover of it, and it says allocation of general fund resources fiscal year 2010-11 by program. This is the current biennium. This is the entire general fund of the state of Minnesota by program. And there's just a couple things that I want to point out to members. You see, first and foremost, this committee share. Incidentally, I'll say that these labels don't work perfectly with committee structure in some areas, but they do in higher ed. The higher ed slice of this pie is all the money that's in this committee, and it's only the money that's in this committee. Other committees are a little less clear on that. But so currently, of the $30.7 billion biennial budget, higher education represents 9.2% of it. A couple of points, members who sit on other budget divisions, I didn't include an all funds pie chart, but for many committees, the all funds budget of the state is twice what the general fund budget is. The all funds budget for 10-11 is almost $60 billion. However, again, this committee, which is quite unusually for committees around here, almost all money spent in this committee is general fund spending. All our appropriations but one are general fund appropriations. So this committee, if you look at the higher education slice on the all funds budget, it just gets smaller because there's more money, but we don't get any of it. So this is a general fund committee. As I say, there is one small health care access appropriation to the University of Minnesota for primary care physician training. Just a note on that, again, if members sit on other budget divisions, they're also, ours are almost exclusively direct appropriations. There are several types of appropriations that we use in the legislature. Direct appropriations, that's when a bill says, you know, $1.2 billion is appropriated to the Board of Regents. There are open appropriations. This committee does not have any open appropriations, and there are actually very few open appropriations in state law. That's one where the money just gets spent without, however much is needed, gets spent. Debt service is an open appropriation. There are no open appropriations in this committee. And statutory appropriations. There are some statutory appropriations in higher education. Fees at the Office of Higher Education come to mind. There are some other ones. Those are appropriated by statute. The committee doesn't have to do anything to have the money get appropriated to the purpose, but the committee may, at its discretion, change things on that. There isn't a lot of that here, but there are some. And I would, let's see, there, oh, in addition, now this 9.2% of the state budget represents $2.8 billion. Went to higher education, and as Ms. Novak said, that's a reduction from the prior biennium and a reduction from the base budget for this biennium. In addition to that, in the last biennium, there was $138 million of federal stimulus funds appropriated in this committee through the Fiscal Stabilization Program and the American Recovery and Rehabilitation Act. That'll become important. I mean, you should know that it was there, and it becomes a little bit important because the state used that money as kind of a cushion as we took the system budgets down, and we took them down to the lowest level the federal law allowed us to take them, which is back to their 2006 level. So we took the University of Minnesota and MNSCU, their budgets went all the way back to where they were in 2006, which is what federal law allowed us. And collectively, we gave them $138 million of federal money to ease the reduction there. Don't have any more, you know, stimulus is over, federal money's gone, so that's, just be aware it was there, but it isn't anymore. I think I'll move on to then the next item in that packet is a three-page draft spreadsheet, and this is only a draft of this year's tracking spreadsheet. I'm not going to go through it in much detail here, but this at this point shows you two things. The first column of numbers shows you the actual spending for various programs and lines in this budget for the current biennium, and it shows you what the base for those programs are in fiscal years 12, 13, which is the next biennium we're going to appropriate for, and what you'll hear referred to as the tails or the out years or the out biennium or any of those phrases, which is fiscal years 14 and 15. And it starts with our Office of Higher Education on the first page and running into the second. The Office of Higher Education, and particularly the first appropriations on there for the agency administration, are the only things in this committee that look much like regular agency appropriations. That's another thing. This committee has fairly large block grants to systems that have governing boards that are charged by statute or by the Constitution and Charter, in the case of the university, with management of the higher ed systems. So the legislature largely block grants that money without a lot of strings on them. In the case of the Office of Higher Education, there are, you know, you see the first dozen or so lines are very basic things, communication, the director's office, that looks like a regular agency. As you go down, you'll see there are some smaller outreach programs. The lower half of the first page is where the financial aid, and as Ms. Novak said, are really the main purpose of the agency, the state grant program and the other main grant programs, work, study, achieve, child care grant for post-secondary, and what the base of those programs are. The start of the second page are the sort of service programs, college intervention for the high for education for high school students and families, and library programs, United Family Practice residency, state's membership in the Midwest Higher Education Compact, we pay dues for that, and reciprocity payments in the state's 529 college savings program. In the middle of the second page, you see we have our smallest account that we appropriate money to is the Mayo Foundation. We pay for capitation grants for spots in both their medical school and the Mayo Family Practice Residency Program. Those are both long-standing programs where the state purchases down the cost of slots in both of those programs.
We have a question, Representative Demke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned that we traditionally have always given the legislature has always appropriated the money in block grants. There isn't a lot of oversight to the to those funds. Is that what I understood you to say?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Depke, mm-hmm. I would not phrase it that there isn't a lot of oversight.
Okay.
I would phrase it that there aren't a lot of requirements on okay. that. The management of those dollars is trusted statutorily and with the charter and constitution yeah. With the system boards.
Yes, that's a better way to say it. Thank you. And that's what you said. Mm-hmm. Why is that because it's in statute? I mean, it's in the constitution that is that the way it has traditionally been because it's a constitutional requirement or it's in statute to do it that way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Depke, it's not. I mean, it could be done otherwise. I guess I will say it's a little different. The University of Minnesota is because of their constitutional status, is a kind of a unique entity. And we can, maybe we don't want to get too far into constitutional autonomy mm-hmm. here.
No.
I'll say sort of briefly that we can appropriate money for specific purposes at the university, and we can have some control and restriction over it, but they have, let me phrase this, we have to be a little cautious about how we do that because they have independent status, and so mm-hmm. we can only go so far, and okay. That's a complicated issue, and maybe yeah. if you want to talk to Ms. Novak further about that.
Yeah.
In the case of Minsky, they're a creature of the state and statute. We could appropriate money to them really in any fashion we wanted. There is a public governing board to manage the system, and it's I think the policy is that the governing board is probably more able to manage the higher education enterprise than the legislature is. And I think the political forces that might take hold were we to be appropriating, for instance, to schools individually are something that really nobody wants to have happen.
Mm-hmm. May I ask another question?
Yeah.
Thank you. When you talk about a public governing board, are you talking about the Board of Regents? Is that what you're referring
Mr.
to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Duffy, yes, the Board of Regents and the Board of Trustees.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Berg, continue.
Mr. Chairman, members, and starting then in the middle of page 2, just below the Mayo Foundation, you'll see the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. There are really three appropriations there. The operations and maintenance appropriation, that's really the cost of educating students and all the things that go with it. There is the central office line that is the administration downtown running the system, and there's a small program, the Learning Network of Minnesota, which used to be at the Office of Higher Education and 2 years ago was transferred to Minsky's control. It nothing changed with the program. It provides electronic education. It's a regionalized network to provide coursework over satellite and private colleges. It's it's really kind of like the TV network. I mean, everybody uses the network. It's just managed by the state. It's subsidized. The cost of it is subsidized by the state, and users purchase time on it. It was moved to MinSCU because they run MinSat, and so they actually really had more of a, they were more suitable to run it anyway than the Office of Higher Education. So, and I will say, while there's only three things there, there typically are then some small items that do get appropriated during the course of a legislative session. So it's not that there are no additional programs, but these are the basic ones that you'll see. And then going to the third page of the spreadsheet, you see the University of Minnesota. And again, you have their major appropriations, operations and maintenance, which is the cost of educating students and non-instructional costs associated with it. The specials at the university, which are based around the topic, the agriculture special, which has the extension service and ag research stations in it. Health sciences, the Institute of Technology, there's a catch-all called the system special. And the most recent one, which is the University Mayo Park Genomics Partnership. Those are separate appropriations to the Board of Regents, and the money can only be used for the purposes within those programs. And then if you look there on line 109 there, you'll see the only non-general fund appropriation that typically appears in the higher education bill, which is a healthcare access fund appropriation to the University of Minnesota to help with primary care physician training. That is to get more primary care physicians out of their medical school. I'll mention one other account that doesn't appear on here, just so nobody's surprised by it. I don't know that we will deal with it this year. We do have another account in this committee, which is the Higher Education Facilities Authority. The Facilities Authority is set up in statute to, issue revenue bonds to construct college facilities primarily at private nonprofit schools. They do not receive an appropriation from the state, a general fund appropriation, never have. They have a small staff, the cost of which is covered by the fees on the revenue bonds from the user colleges. And the only time they really ever come up in this committee is periodically there is an aggregate debt cap set in statute for the total amount of debt they can issue. And periodically we have raised that debt cap. Since it went up substantially last year, I don't think we'll probably deal with that this year, but members should just be aware that's an account we have. And then moving on to the last sheet that is in that packet, it's just a long-term tracking. It goes for some 35 years that just looks at the actual spending, or depending on the year, appropriation or forecast appropriation for each of the systems, the Office of Higher Education, the Mayo, against the higher ed total spending in the general fund budget, against the general fund, and percentage comparisons of all of those over a long period of time. And I just put that out there because this sheet, probably, I would guess, half of the questions I get every biennium are related to data that's on this sheet, and it tends to generate some discussion. And I think, Mr. Chair, that's all I'll cover. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
We have a question.
I'm happy to meet with members as well if they'd like further information.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still kind of grappling with appropriations. And as I'm looking at the financial aid state grant program, looks like it's $288,000. Over the biennium.
Million,
I'm sorry. Thank you. Over the biennium. Are there strings to that money? Is it federal match money? Is it all state money? Is it general fund money that we could choose to put toward tuition? And if we did put it toward tuition, I know what that means is it goes into the U of M or MinSCU's general fund and they would appropriate it, so it isn't, if we chose to make some shifts, we wouldn't have control once we put it in the pot. I guess I'm kind of looking for some guidance there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, it is just as one thing. On the spreadsheet, every number add three zeros to it. So it's $288 million is the biennial base for that program. And it's, Representative Norton, it's all general fund money, and we, the legislature could do anything it wanted with that. It could eliminate the program and spend the money another way. It could change the program. It really, any way the legislature would choose to change the statute. And also, we could fund it at different levels without changing the statute. There are mechanisms in the statute to prorate the funds if there are insufficient funds for the need, and there are also mechanisms in the statute for distribution of surplus funds if there's extra money in the fund above the estimated need. So the legislature really has pretty free hand to either change the program or not, or fund it at a different level or not.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up with that. But I want to be clear on the part two of my rambling here, was that if we do put it in a different pot, if we take it out of the financial aid state grant pot and put it in the larger budget, do we have control over where it would go? For instance, could we direct it to lower tuition for all students, or does it just go into the U of M appropriation and they can do what they want? Do we have any way to control that?
Again, Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, it would depend on how the language of the statutory change or the law change, because it might be in session law. Certainly, we could set up a new program that worked like a grant program to some, how we would do it, but which would be operated by an outside entity like OHE that then would pass out grants to the systems where the legislature would have complete control over it. We could put it into the systems theoretically and say this appropriation is only for such purposes. Certainly we can do that at Minsku, and we can, broadly speaking, you know, we could do that with new money at the university for that sort of a purpose, but there would be a lot of latitude on the legislature's part if that,
Representative Morrill,
that would happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Berg, for the explanation. I know we'll have substantial conversations about the state grant program and how it's used out, but I want to ask you, Mr. Berg, is that program in deficit right now, and if so, the degree to deficit, and do we know, for example, have we had greater demand on the program and therefore can't meet the needs of all those who have been qualified requesting support under the state grant program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrow, there's an easy answer and a more complicated answer. The easy answer is that the program had much greater demand in fiscal 2010 than it was anticipated. The state grant program can borrow money forward and backward between years of the biennium. So what that meant in practice is that a lot of the second year money was spent in the first year covering first year demand, causing a shortfall for the second year. That triggered proration of the statutory proration language, and we talked about this in the last legislative session. So the office, knowing there was not enough money to cover need, prorated the grants to students. And then this is where it gets slightly complicated, because technically there's actually a slight surplus. They prorated it to a level so that they knew they weren't going to spend too much money. Then they went back and, under the portion of the statute that says if there's surplus money, you have to give it out a different way, they gave some of what they had kind of budgeted as the excess at the end back, and there's just a little bit left. And we're still only in the middle of the year, so that's still an estimate. But so there's a deficit, but then there's also a surplus.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, and maybe, Mr. Berg, this is surmising on my part that we can investigate in a later committee meeting, but if I understand correctly on the increased demand, we had students already in college whose family income fell, and therefore they became eligible when they may not have been eligible earlier in their college career. We had folks who were unemployed who went back to college and were eligible, increasing the demand. Am I right on understanding at least some of the economic factors that may have led to the increased demand? And then the second half is, if a student's state grant number goes down, that doesn't mean their tuition goes down. That means they need to come up with that money some other way. Do I have that right?
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrow, you're right and right. The first part of your question, the state grant is sort of simple in its concept, but I often tell members to think about it a little bit like the tax structure. What you get, there were more students, there was more need. Students who were in the program were poorer than they were before, and tuition went up. So I mean, you have all these factors creating pressure on the program. That said, then the second part of your question, yeah, when they prorate grants, a student just gets less money, but their tuition bill is the same. So they are then and furthermore, I will say, since our program piggybacks on the federal Pell Grant, what you typically get is a grant. You have financial need is assessed, and then the federal government goes first. Student gets a Pell Grant if they're eligible. Some students only get a Pell Grant and then they're done. Many students get a Pell Grant and then the balance of their need is filled in by the state grant program. There are some students who receive only a state grant, but the biggest chunk is the middle group that get both. So if the state grant goes down, the Pell Grant doesn't go up. There's just a hole, and the student can either, you know, they can do what they can do, take out loans, work, borrow from mom and dad, whatever.
Any other questions from members? Oh, Representative Norton.
This may be more than you can answer, but it just begs a follow-up here. Is there any data collected on the number of students who are given a state grant but only go a year or two and drop out and then don't finish a four-year degree?
Mr. Berg?
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton. I'm going to actually ask Tricia to say, we have looked at that in the past. We did a big study, the office, I should say, did a big study a couple of years ago, which I think could answer that. But on a routine basis, I don't think we can.
And just for clarification, I didn't say four-year degree, but there are an equal number or large number of students going for two-year or end programs that I'd have the same question for if they don't finish.
Identify yourself, please, for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. A few years ago, we did a study on persistence of state grant recipients and students who did not receive state grants. And for full-time students, the persistence was very similar, which was actually very surprising because the state grant recipients are lower income, and they tend to come from families that have more risk factors for dropping out, such as being the first in their families ever to go to college. Perhaps, not always, but perhaps entering college with not as good preparation in high school, and a tendency to attend when they're a little older and working more hours per week and that kind of thing, to tend to be correlated with a higher rate of dropout. And so the fact that the full-time students persisted at about the same rate was actually a good result, I think people would say. So it was much harder to analyze for the part-time students, because for the part-time students, there are so many reasons they could be part-time. It may be that they're caring for small children or other family members. Maybe that they're working for more hours per week because they're an adult and no one else can help pay their bills. There's a whole range of different causes. But I don't have a real short answer to your question. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Ms. Novak, Mr. Berg, for your presentations. And we did miss the pages when we were introducing everyone. So if you would stand and introduce yourselves, please.
Hi there, everybody. My name is Charlie Moberg. I'm Secretary of the Internet.
Hi, I'm
Gail Tate.
This is my first question.
Okay. Welcome. Very important part of our committee. One final thing, an announcement here from the University of Minnesota. All of you, I think, received an invitation to a tour of the new Science Teaching and Student Services building. They're having tours and a reception this afternoon from 3 to 5, and even if you didn't respond, you're still welcome to attend if you have time. So that's today. With that, we will adjourn. Our next meeting will be on Thursday, same time. Thank you.